You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Around the U.S., military bases are gearing up for a war against Iraq. Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia, is one of the largest military bases in the U.S. and the home of the U.S. Army Infantry School and the elite Army Rangers. But Fort Benning draws the attention of Americans for another reason. It is also home to the controversial School of the Americas, recently renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. It's defined by many as a terrorist camp on U.S. soil. This weekend, thousands protested outside Fort Benning to call for the closing of the School of the Americas. There were speeches from the young and the old alike.
Hello, I'm Eva. I'm very happy to be with you again. I was here 2 years ago, as Chris said. I am here because I really want this school to shut down. I want to close the school like you do. When I was 4 years old, my mother was kidnapped by the Argentinian military. My little sister was 2 and my brother was 3 years old. We were in a coffee shop. They came in, they were around 10, with guns. My mother saw them, she ran away. They shot her in the legs. They dragged her into a car and they took her away. They stole her from us. And after that, they took the three of us to a police station where they interrogated us for hours, asking about our dad. But they realized that we didn't know anything, we couldn't speak, really. So they took us to an orphanage. And I think they took us there because they wanted us to be adopted by military families who couldn't have children, because that's what they did with their children, either kill them or give them in adoption to military families. But I was really lucky we were with my brother and sister, because a journalist came, took picture of us and published the picture in three newspapers in the city of Buenos Aires, saying that we were found lost in the streets. And my grandmother saw the pictures and she was able to pick us up, and we live with her in the north of Argentina since there. 2 years later, they kidnapped my mother, they also kidnapped my dad. So they are 2 of the 30,000 disappeared, they are in Argentina. And my sister, my brother, and me grew up in a society who was filled with silence, was a lot of silence in the society. It was a lot of fear. But one day when we finally grew up, we realized that we were not the only ones, that happened to us, that happened to other children too. So we started a group in 1995 called Hijos. And this group was born with the idea of fighting for justice. We are all children of the disappeared, children of political prisoners, children of exile, and children of people who were marked by the dictatorships. The group started in Argentina and spread all over Latin America. Now, 2 years ago, we started a group in Canada, and there is a group of Hijos also in Europe. And we really want justice to be done. So that's why, for us, it's really important to stay here today with you, because I'm really happy to see all of you here, because you are the only ones who can close this school down, you as U.S. citizens, because they have to listen to you. And this school is responsible for what happened in our countries, for the disappearances and killings of many parents and many people. And you do have to struggle for that. In Latin America, the people have this mistaken idea that the U.S. citizens support what the governments do with the rest of the countries. And you have to take back your country, and you have to tell the world, you have to tell the world that the U.S. people does not support them, that the U.S. people does not support war, does not support bloody dictatorships. When I was a kid, after they took my parents, I used to have the dream that they will come back. When I realized that they wouldn't, I had the dream that someday I will find justice, that justice will be made. And this is one step for justice to be made. And thank you. I want to thank you, all of you, for staying here and working to be able to make that dream come true. Thank you.
Both Ava's parents were disappeared by soldiers trained at the School of the Americas. Peace Watch reporter Laurel Paget-Seekins attended the weekend protests and files this report that many at the rally see an Iraqi connection to their protest.
As the U.S. Army builds up for war against Iraq, over 10,000 people gathered outside Fort Benning, Georgia this weekend to protest the School of the Americas. Dubbed the School of Assassins and a terrorist training camp by activists, the SOA has trained some of the most notorious human rights abusers in Latin America. With the war looming, some of the protesters thought it was more important than ever to be there. Jesse, who later crossed onto the base, shared his reasoning.
I think that perception of this, though, changes a lot in terms of the fact that people do think that the country should be united, that no matter how just a criticism might be, now is not the time to make it. And I guess I think that this is the exact time to make it. The things that we're protesting right now outside of Fort Benning are directly related to war on Iraq and to our general military buildup, our general foreign policy. And I'm really glad that they didn't cancel it after September 11th. I'm glad that they haven't canceled it this year. I think that would give entirely the wrong statement.
So, President, somebody drops a few bombs on Iraq, exactly like President, what's his name, a couple years back, and people who thought that they'd voted against.
Besides hosting the infamous training school for Latin American military, Fort Benning also is the site of basic training for many U.S. soldiers. Paul, a World War II skipper and member of Veterans for Peace, doubts the protesters' message would reach the soldiers preparing to go to Iraq.
Well, I certainly hope that the soldiers will be alerted by what we're doing, but I strongly suspect the demonizing and manipulation of their minds by Fort Benning. I mean, after all, Fort Benning is a place where you're taught to be soldiers. That means you're taught to kill or be killed. And once you're part of a group like that, you're not going to be easily moved away from it. But I think what we're doing is very important.
This is the 13th year human rights advocates have gathered in Columbus, Georgia to mark the anniversary of the killing of six Jesuit priests in El Salvador by SOA graduates. Sarah, who's attended the demonstration for the past 4 years, feels that the SOA movement has affected the military town.
People have a lot of dialogue in the places where we eat, the places where we stay in town. The demonstration's on a weekend, so it's not like that we're interacting with all the people who drive onto the base every day. But, I mean, Columbus, Georgia, as a community, is influenced so greatly by this protest. And I feel like we are, in a way, that the SOA Watch movement is a permanent part of the community, not just one demonstration a year. It's always in people's minds.
Since September 11th and the start of the War on Terror, the welcome has been less warm. In 2001, the military built a fence to keep the protesters off the base, and the city of Columbus tried to deny the organizers, SOA Watch, permits. This year, the city police department set up a perimeter and searched everyone entering the protest. Many felt this was a violation of their First and Fourth Amendment rights and told the police so. This year, some residents of Columbus organized a counter-event on Sunday called God Bless Fort Benning Day. 24 people with signs supporting the military gathered a few blocks from the SOA protest site. A local radio station urged people to come down.
God bless Fort Benning Day. Millions of people Williams out here cooking. She's got great Spanish food, Latin American food. There's a Latin American band playing. Don't be afraid. There's plenty of police down here. It's a very peaceful protest. But, you know, marriage is a marriage. The freedom to protest comes because our soldiers had the courage to fight for it. So come on down. God bless Fort Benning, Jay. We're expecting you.
The police didn't search these protesters. Lisa, a student from Michigan attending the SOA protest, questioned the double standards.
I support their right to hold a counter demonstration. I mean, we had to struggle to have our protest and go through court, and they did not. And I think that that's too bad that there's that double standard here. I also think it's unfortunate that none of the members of the counter protest are coming forward to speak with any of the members of the SOA protest, because I'd really like to speak with them and find out their personal opinions and why they're here and why they're holding signs that say "Thank you, Fort Benning, and you make us proud." Because I think that the most important thing in creating a better world that exists in peace is starting the dialogue. You need to talk with people and understand people before you can have any of that.
Back at the front gate, over 90 people walked around the fence to cross onto the base, risking 6 months in prison. And the SOA Watch organizers promised to be back, regardless of the welcome by Columbus, until the SOA, by any name, is closed. 10-year-old Quinn, who lives just feet from the Fort Benning fence and has grown up with the SOA Watch movement coming to town, had these words to share.
God loves everybody. Thank you.
From the Atlanta Independent Media Center, Columbus Annex, I'm Laurel Padgett-Seekins.
In a change from previous years, the 96 people arrested at Fort Benning yesterday were held in a county jail last night and arraigned in federal court today. Bail was set at $5,000 and a trial date was set for January 27th. In the past, School of the America protesters were released without bail and only a small number of those who crossed onto the base were charged. Collectively, over 100 people have spent close to 70 years in prison for protesting the SOA. Currently, 26 people are behind bars for crossing onto the base last November. The U.S. government seems determined to prevent new weapons inspections from succeeding in Iraq and instead wants to wage war in the Middle East in order to advance American economic and military supremacy. That's according to Scott Ritter. In a bold speech before a standing room only crowd on Veterans Day at the University of Maryland, the former Marine and U.N. weapons inspector, who has gained international fame for opposing U.S. policy toward Iraq, brought home the images of what it means to be at war and the results of the sanctions on Iraq.
The average age of a Marine Corps Lance Corporal who's getting ready to go to war is 20 years old. The average age of your college students is 20 years old. Somehow, the mere act of me standing before you and challenging my government on the issue of Iraq is seen as less than ideal. I reject that. I may not be right. I may be wrong. But you can never question any American's duty and responsibility to speak their mind when they feel that something is wrong. It is the most patriotic thing you can do as an American. And right now we are talking about going to war. Look in the mirror long and hard and say, is what's going on in Iraq worthy of my life? Am I willing to die for Iraq? Am I willing to have my brother die, my sister die, my father die, my mother die, my cousin, my friend, anybody? Am I willing to have somebody close to me die for Iraq? Am I willing to give my life for Iraq? If the answer is no, why in God's name would you sit back silently while you have others go off and die for you? We're talking about war, ladies and gentlemen. War. It's not a game. It's real. War's about killing, plain and simple. Death and destruction. Sometimes it's we who do the killing. Sometimes it's we who get killed. But in the end, that's all it's about. And we're going to terminate a lot of life in the near future if we do go to war. Most of the lives we'll terminate will be civilians, innocent civilians caught in the middle. I'm an intelligence officer. My job is to go out and collect information, to collate it, assess it, determine what's relevant and what's not. So they had to bring in people like me to go in and gather the data from Iraq that Iraq chose not to turn over. Because I have to tell you, from the very beginning, the United States has not been very straightforward on Iraq. The international community found that Iraq had to be disarmed and created weapons inspectors to go into Iraq and oversee this disarmament. One of the key elements of this whole process of disarmament was the means of compelling Iraq to cooperate. The bombs we dropped on Iraq didn't just drop on the top of Iraqi soldiers. We dropped bombs on water purification facilities. We dropped bombs on power plants. We dropped bombs on pretty much the totality of Iraq's civil infrastructure, especially in and around Baghdad. So that when you turn on that water tap and put that glass underneath it, the water you now held up was tainted with raw sewage. And if you drink it, you're going to get sick. If you're a child under the age of 5, especially a child that might be suffering from a little bit of malnutrition because of economic sanctions, your immune system isn't fully developed. Your body can't handle it. You get sick, and you need treatment. Let's say your mom picks you up, takes you to the hospital, goes to the doctor. Now, normally, the doctor will be able to pull out some antibiotics and some other form of treatment and take care of this problem pretty quickly. But now, because of sanctions, there are no medicines. Because the power plant was blown up, there is no refrigeration. You need refrigeration to keep certain medicines in storage. All the medicines have expired. So the mother brings her child in, holds it up to the doctor and says, "Doc, here's the baby." The doctor says, "There's nothing I can do for the child." The child dies. Now, but the child just doesn't die. The child wastes away. And imagine the pain the mother feels as she watches her child die day by day by day. And then she has to bury the child. This doesn't happen one time, or 5 times, or 10 times, or 100 times. It happens thousands of times. By some estimates, 3,000 to 5,000 children under the age of 5 perished every month during a sustained period of 3 to 4 years in the mid-1990s as a direct result of economic sanctions. So when we talk about sanctions and sanctioning Iraq, keep that in the back of your head. You know, we say we're doing it because we want to compel Saddam Hussein to cooperate. Well, that's pretty neat, you know. Gosh, that's the equivalent of me saying, okay, you know, we're going to go into an Iraqi village and we're going to round up 3,000 to 5,000 children under the age of 5, and we're going to hold them hostage. And I'm going to send a message to Saddam. I said, "Saddam, cooperate. If you don't cooperate, we're going to gun these kids down." And at the end of the month, Saddam doesn't cooperate, and I turn to my Marines and I say, "Load the machine guns, ready, aim, fire." And as soon as I say fire, nothing happens. Why? Because Marines don't kill kids. That just ain't what we do. Oh, but don't be patting yourself on the back too much, ladies and gentlemen, because guess what? We do kill kids. We just don't shoot them. We starve them to death. Make them die of treatable diseases. We let them waste away silently over there, beyond the range of the TV camera, beyond the range of American heartstrings. You know, how many people here are aware of the fact that many kids are dying every month? How many people are aware of the fact that it's our fault that many kids are dying every month? How many people are ashamed of that? We have collective guilt here, ladies and gentlemen. When I talk of government of the people, by the people, for the people, I mean it. And what happens in your name happens in your name. You're responsible. Don't blame the Bush administration. Don't blame the Clinton administration. Don't blame government. You're the government. You're responsible. The deaths of these Iraqi kids are on your hands. It's on my hands. It's on all of our hands. In the same way that the death of these Americans that we're sending off to war in the next couple months is on our hands. Collective responsibility. We are the government. What are we doing to hold our elected representatives accountable? Now, some people say it's bad form to be up here talking about this in this fashion. You know, I got a couple things to say about that. One, where I come from in Albany, New York, we talk about certain things like the dredging of the Hudson River. Big issue. General Electric dumped some PCBs in there. Now there's a big debate. Do we dredge? Don't we dredge? And it's an amazing thing that happens. The citizens come together in groups. They have debates, discussions, dialogue. They bring their elected representatives in for town hall meetings, and they hold them accountable for what they say. They ask questions, probing questions about dredging. How will it affect the economy? How will it affect the ecology? Is this the right thing to be doing? And at the end of the day, they have a vote, and one side wins. And when that side wins, do they stand up to the other side and say, "Traitor, treasonous, how dare you speak out against the policy?" No. It's democracy in action. It's what makes this country great. Power of the people. We get involved. But how can we do that at the local level? We have a different standard at the national level. If the mayor of my town came up one day and said, "You know, ladies and gentlemen, Albany, New York, I'm raising taxes. You're going to accept it. You're either with me or against me." Would we accept that? Not on your life. in the summer of 1991, then Secretary of State James Baker said the following: it doesn't matter if Iraq cooperates with its obligation to disarm. Economic sanctions will be maintained until which time Saddam Hussein is removed from power. That's the United States policy, ladies and gentlemen. Regime removal, and it's been in place for over a decade now. Everything about weapons inspections has been just a farce. We have no intention of allowing weapons inspectors to work in Iraq. Never had and never will.
Scott Ritter, the former U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq, speaking at the University of Maryland. Thanks to Reem Kathuta, WPFW correspondent to Peace Watch, for providing that segment. Graphic artist Eric Drucker's watercolors and scratchboard drawings have been seen in publications such as The New Yorker and the underground comic journal World War III. His work has also documented progressive social movements on the walls and signposts of his native Lower East Side in New York and in Berkeley, California, where he now resides. Two of his most widely recognized works include the electrified radio tower that represented the movement to restore Pacifica, and his stark portrait of journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal with a typewriter extending beyond the bars of his death row jail cell. His books include the graphic novel Flood, his collaboration with Allen Ginsberg titled Illuminated Poems, and most recently Blood Song, a silent ballad. Eric Drucker spoke with Robert Knight of Pacifica Station WBAI about Blood Song, War, and Peace.
I think Seth Tobachman pointed out that an artist's style, almost by definition, is the thing that the artist himself can't see. You know, I feel like my style has evolved over the years. I was doing political cartoons, and now I'm much less cartoony, more of a kind of expressionistic approach. It's hard, you know, to talk about one's work. It's like trying to look at one's own eyeball or try to bite one's own teeth. You can't really do it. I mean, not to, you know, mystify art. I just see art as another language. Visual art is a language just like spoken, you know, where literature is, it's all about communication. I think this is something that it's obvious, I think, with words that we're trying to communicate. Right now I'm speaking, I'm trying to communicate specific thoughts and ideas and emotions and concepts. The way visual art, certainly the way it was taught to me at Cooper Union, it was more about that this is a method of expression. It's all about expression, which to me seemed implicit. Obviously it's about personal expression, but beyond that, I for me anyway, it's very much about communication. You could communicate, you know, certain abstract emotions that we all have, but we could also use visual art to communicate very specific ideas and specific feelings that perhaps we couldn't communicate in words or with words alone. Blood Song is a story that I felt like I couldn't have told in words.
I'm looking at a portion of Blood Song in which your protagonist, the young woman, is heading home with her dog with a pot of water on her head, and she breaks out of the foliage to see her village surrounded by soldiers and the sky peppered with helicopters, natives being harassed, and herself in a gunshot rifle chase through the woods at the hands of the soldiers. What are you saying here? What are you saying about war, about military occupation or such things?
Well, how sudden it comes upon us. We're not quite prepared. You know, we see wars on the horizon. You know, his daddy was talking about a new world order. That was very ominous. And then, oh, did he steal the election or what? Or even if it had been Gore, I don't know that it would have been even all that different necessarily. It's funny, after 9/11, I was wondering, like, what if, you know, let's say it was that the Democrats had fought for their seat and held it and actually were in office. You would have had Gore Lieberman, who probably would have had to just prove how fascist they were. Even though we're Democrats, we could be just as hard-ass. Probably would have been even, you know, would have blundered into war even quicker just to prove a point. I think on foreign policy, it would have been just as bad vis-a-vis the Middle East with the Joe Lieberman, vice president, head of the Democratic Leadership Council, the far right wing of the Democratic Party. Domestically, it's hard to say. Domestically, it's hard to believe that things would have been quite would have gotten this Orwellian this quickly, with, you know, appointing Tom Ridge as a homeland defense and making that so much of a priority now. Appointing John Ashcroft, Rumsfeld, these characters like, well, we're not even going to dwell on Dick Cheney, but Rumsfeld, whom Henry Kissinger referred to as the most ruthless man I have ever met. This is coming from Henry, so look out. These guys mean business, and I think it's for real. Suddenly, it's upon us. We're not really prepared. Like that old blues song, what are you going to do when death comes knocking at your door? Or when they steal your mother away, your father away? You don't really have time to prepare. You don't have time to get ready when death comes knocking at the door.
You feel that we're at that point of sudden involvement that the woman was in Bloodsong?
Certainly in the story. In art, one sometimes has to exaggerate just to make the point. So the city where she arrives in the final chapter of Bloodsong is a city very much like ours, but perhaps a little bit exaggerated. You notice there are hidden cameras everywhere. You may not notice on the first few viewings, but there are enough details in this book that you could actually read it. You have to kind of decipher all the imagery, and you won't get it all the first time. You'll get a lot of the subplots and subtleties will happen perhaps the second or third time you read it. Read in, you know, quotation marks, quote unquote. Though I do think, you know, we do read pictures.
I'm wondering now, as we go into another war, whether that affects you as well, whether you anticipate any evolution in how you describe the people that you portray so faithfully in your drawings and paintings.
Well, yes, of course it'll affect me, just like it'll affect everyone on the street. I mean, there's no ivory tower to hide in at this point, right? The ivory towers have been leveled to the ground, and how it will affect the, you know, the stylistic evolution of my work, time will tell, but it will be affecting everyone's work. There, you know, the songs, the poetry, it will have a big impact, you know. It's continuing to, it's very much of a continuum, you know. Suddenly it may get ratcheted up to another degree of red alert, but I see that we're very much in it right now. When do we get to call it, you know, use the F word, fascism? At what point does it, you know, what percentage of the population has to be incarcerated behind bars before, you know, one could call it fascism? You know, when is the dish going to hit the fan? Well, it already is hitting the fan for a lot of people on the planet, you know.
Graphic artist Eric Drucker with Robert Knight. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our engineer today was Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett of KPFA, Aisha Morris, Toussaint Savoir, Tom Gomez, and Chris Strom. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.